welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. In this week's program, we'll be discussing the little-known history of U.S. African relations with Sally Booker, Director of Africa Action. We'll also be hearing from Alan Winkler on the history of civil defense in America. But before we get to those subjects, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On February 23, 1945, one of the most indelible images of World War II was captured on film. 4 days after American Marines landed on the Japanese-occupied island of Iwo Jima in the final months of the Pacific War, the American Stars and Stripes was raised atop Mount Suribachi, signaling American victory. The victory, however, was not yet theirs, and it was to come at a heavy price. The desolate volcanic island was defended by a garrison of 22,000 Japanese soldiers whose skillful construction of concrete and steel fortifications compounded a natural landscape of adverse conditions to create a nightmare in waiting for anyone who dared try to capture the island. The island had to be taken, however, as it was a vital link in Japan's inner ring of defenses and because it contained 3 airstrips needed for the American strategic bombing offensive against the Japanese mainland. It took 36 days, over 800 warships, and 200,000 soldiers, one-third of whom were lost in battle to secure the island. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a mangled, twisted set of window blinds from a World Trade Center office, a Red Cross coffee cup, and a card displaying the U.S. flag made of macaroni painted in red, white, and blue are just a few items preserved as historical museum pieces and as reminders of the tragedy of September 11th. Museum curators, historians, artists, and archivists are collecting and preserving thousands of items that may be historically significant because of their relationship with the World Trade Center disaster. Nearly 50 years after convicted spies Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were executed for conspiring to disclose American atomic secrets to the Soviet Union, Ethel's brother, David Greenglass, revealed that he lied under oath concerning his sister's alleged espionage activities. In a new book, The Brother, Greenglass reveals that he committed perjury in court and before a congressional committee by providing information that helped send his sister to the electric chair. Admitting that he, too, was a spy who gave the Soviets information, Greenglass confesses that he based his testimony entirely upon his wife's recollection, not his own, and that he was motivated by his desire to keep his wife out of prison and gain leniency for himself. This is Talking History. One of the largest segments of the American population has roots in Africa. We've had relations with countries on the continent for over a century, and from time to time, we've even sent troops to various locations. Yet we know little about the history of U.S.-African relations. Time to get caught up on this important topic with Talking History's Terry Clark.
For much of the last half century, the United States has ranked as one of the great powers in the international system. The extent of its influence and reach is global. Yet it seemingly ignores one of the world's largest continents, Africa. Here today to discuss the issue of U.S.-African relations with us is Sally Booker. Mr. Booker is the Executive Director of Africa Action. He was previously Senior Fellow and Director of the Africa Studies Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to our show, Mr. Booker.
Thank you for having me.
Let me start by asking you, what was the first African country with which the United States opened formal diplomatic relations?
Well, that would be the North African country of Morocco, which has the distinction of being the first African country to actually recognize the government of the United States in 1977. And formal U.S. relations with Morocco date to 1787, when the two nations negotiated a treaty of peace and friendship. It's been renegotiated in 1836, and it's still in force, making it the longest unbroken treaty relationship in U.S. history.
So they recognized this in 1777?
That's right, a year after the revolution.
Why did the state or Morocco do this? I mean, was there a particular reason for it?
Well, they had an interest in making new friends all around the world because much of their history has been shaped by their geographic location, as is often the case with many other countries. And I think they had an interest at the time of reaching out and having possibly other allies to balance the interests of their closer neighbors, particularly those in Europe, that had certain designs on Morocco. And, of course, later the French made Morocco a protectorate.
I see. And what countries then followed?
Well, the next country in line would have been Algeria, with which the United States also signed a treaty of peace and amity in September 1795. And again, that's in North Africa. In sub-Saharan Africa, the first country with which the United States had diplomatic relations was with Liberia. And that is, of course, a somewhat complicated but very important history. The United States actually helped create the country of Liberia through the American Colonization Society. It was seen at the time as a way of possibly resolving the United States' own controversy over slavery, and the American Colonization Society encouraged the repatriation or deportation, if you will, of enslaved Africans from the United States to the territory of Liberia.
During the era of decolonization following the end of World War II, did most newly emerging independent African states within a very short period of time establish relations with the United States and us with them?
They did indeed, and that was a period marked by a great deal of optimism, a great deal of enthusiasm about this large number of newly emerging states, particularly in Africa, but also in Asia and Latin America during roughly this same period. And the United States not only established diplomatic ties with countries as they became independent, but they initiated small programs of development assistance. Shortly thereafter, during that period, the Peace Corps were created, which played a key role in helping to educate a lot of Americans about Africa while also extending assistance to a number of African countries.
Are there any African states that exist today with which we do not have, or with which the United States does not have, formal diplomatic relations at present?
Right. The United States does not have formal diplomatic relations with the North African country of Libya. We have suspended full diplomatic relations with the state of Sudan, though we do have diplomatic presence. The United States has certain sanctions imposed upon the government of Sudan. Because Somalia does not have a recognized government internationally, the United States no longer has diplomatic relations in Somalia, and most of the the rest of the continent, and again, that's a continent of 53 countries, the United States does have diplomatic ties, some obviously much stronger than others.
Returning to the early years of the American Republic, the 18th century, how would you characterize the relations of the United States in the early years with the countries in Africa?
Well, you know, the United States' history with Africa is really part and parcel of America's history and its struggle with the question of race and the color line in the United States itself. America's earliest policies toward Africa, of course, were really reflected in slavery and in the enslavement of African people. And the evolution of American society had a lot to do with the destruction of African identity, cultures, values, etc. So there was a very negative view of Africa on the part of the ruling authorities in the United States during this period. And that's what led the United States through the American Colonization Society in 1820 to begin trying to find a solution of getting rid of all these Africans in the United States that had helped build the country by deporting them to Liberia. And Liberia finally had its first black president and was declared an independent state in 1847, but the United States refused to recognize this independent black state that it had helped create until 18 years later in 1865. That also happened to be the same year that ended the U.S. Civil War and marked the emancipation of slaves in this country. But after Liberia, the United States continued to have an interest in Africa, but largely saw Africa as the domain of the European powers, and deferred largely to Britain, to France, to Portugal, the major colonial powers in Africa, when it came to international relations regarding Africa. One other interesting case is, of course, the case of the Congo. And there, the United States' support for King Leopold II in his effort to gain the colony for Belgium, or more importantly, for his own personal possession, had devastating results on the African people at the time. King Leopold is believed to have caused the death of somewhere as many as possible 10 million Africans during a genocidal exploitation of slave labor there. But the Belgian monarch was able to do this because the United States was the first country to recognize his claim to the Congo and to persuade the other European countries to accept Belgian colonization of the Congo.
If we were to try to periodize or mark major periods in U.S.-African relations, what would you suggest would be a good way to go about doing that?
Well, I think there is that early period that we were just talking about in the 1800s. I mean, this was a period where the United States deferred to European powers. Its only interests in Africa were the Africans in the United States, essentially, and the slave trade. But it did not pursue colonies, and its economic ties were somewhat limited because the European powers had basically control of the larger part of trade with and in Africa. The next major period was really the period leading up to decolonization, where the United States, after World War II, found itself somewhat supportive of African decolonization efforts, independence struggles, and as with the advent of the Cold War, had a very serious interest in making sure that newly independent African states would be pro-American. American foreign policy still tended to defer a bit to European interests and powers in Africa, but that began to shift a little as the Cold War became more intense and the United States invested more in winning friends in Africa or buying friends in Africa, as the case often was. I think the next major phase, of course, was this period of the second wave of independence in Africa. The end of the Cold War coincided with a period in Africa that saw the demise of one-party states, the demise of military dictatorships for the most part, and an emerging new, more democratic Africa that was having more success with economic growth. But sadly, that also coincided with a period of declining U.S. interest because there was no more a Cold War to provoke competition in Africa, and because of the United States' experience in Somalia, where following what was titled a humanitarian mission in 1993, saw the death of a number of American Marines, and the United States pulled out in 1994, and this began a period often referred to as after the Mogadishu line. In other words, an unwillingness on the part of the United States to become too committed or invested militarily, politically, or economically in African affairs because of how American national interests were defined at that time.
When have U.S.-African relations been at their best?
Well, they're real differences. I mean, there's the symbols and the substance. One could say in 1998, when President Bill Clinton went on a major tour of African countries, it was his longest trip overseas. He visited 6 African countries during the course of, I believe it was 12 days to 2 weeks. It raised the visibility of African-U.S. relations beyond anything that had preceded it. And during that same year, virtually every cabinet secretary in the U.S. made trips to a variety of African countries, a number of cabinet secretaries visiting more than one occasion. And the following year, there was a very large ministerial meeting here in Washington with African ministers, foreign trade, finance ministers from most African countries, meeting their senior American counterparts. So that symbolically and rhetorically was a period of renewed embrace of Africa by the United States, a greater emphasis on trade and growing relations. But the substance reveals a slightly different story. During the same period, there was a decline in U.S. development assistance to Africa. There was not a real noticeable increase in trade with Africa, with oil exporting countries like Nigeria or Angola still predominating the limited trade between the United States and Africa. And during this same period, the United States refused to intervene during the horrible genocide in Rwanda in 1994, in part as a consequence because of the American experience in Somalia. So this was a period where relations were largely seen as good and moving in the right direction because of the high symbolism, because of the high rhetoric. But in terms of the substance and changing institutional relations or increasing serious American investments in Africa, whether financial, diplomatic, or security investments, it was really a mixed period. And we may be entering a new period currently, following the events of September 11th, more like the Cold War, where African countries will be viewed in terms of what they have to offer the United States in its war against terrorism, a greater geostrategic evaluation of African countries, and less attention given to their own internal challenges.
You know, when I travel, I frequently hear scholars commenting that Africa is the continent with which we really have the least developed relations and the least well-defined national interests. Do you think that's an accurate observation?
I think it is. We certainly have the least developed relations. Just a couple of weeks ago, there was the first ever U.S.-Africa Trade and Economic Development Forum held in Washington. There were over 200 African development ministers from all over the continent, and it hardly received any attention in the press. This is a new forum that was required by law, legislation passed by Congress in the year 2000. And Africa was the only remaining region for which the United States had no institutional vehicle for periodic or annual high-level talks on economic cooperation. So Africa as a region is still playing catch-up in terms of the mechanisms and institutions to manage and improve relations with the United States. In terms of how America's national interests in Africa are defined, I would agree only in the extent that America's national interests, the definition of America's national interests have historically excluded Africa, when in fact one could argue that America has very real and long-standing historic national interests in Africa. America is a country of African descent, if you will, not just because of the large percentage of African Americans in this country, but because American culture, American history is so deeply intertwined with the African community that was a very important part of creating this society. But in modern times, if one simply now recognizes that no country can be an island of prosperity in the world amidst the sea of despair, one recognizes that global threats affect us all wherever we live, and thus whether it's terrorism, whether it's HIV/AIDS, where Africa is the epicenter of that pandemic, these are common concerns, and the only way to address these concerns and improve human security for our society is to be engaged everywhere in the world to fight for common concerns that we share with people in Africa as we do elsewhere in the world.
In the remaining minute that we have, what do you believe is the future for U.S.-African relations?
Well, I'm deeply concerned because right now, Africa faces, the world faces the greatest plague in human history, and that is the AIDS pandemic. It will soon outstrip the bubonic plague, the Spanish flu, all other plagues and massive public health crises that the world has ever faced. And the United States has the wealthiest country in human history right now. How it responds to this pandemic will determine, to a large extent, the strength of U.S.-African relations going forward. So I'm very concerned, but I'm hopeful because I believe the American public will respond and gain the attention of policymakers.
Mr. Booker, thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
You have been listening to Mr. Saleh Booker, the Executive Director of Africa Action. For more information on this and other topics, visit Africa Action's website at africapolicy.org.
Protection of the homeland is all the talk these days. We used to call it civil defense, but it was much the same, raising similar questions. Just how do we protect the American people? And where are we safe from attack? Historian Alan Winkler tackles these questions in this week's commentary.
Where are you safe from a possible attack? That question has been asked over and over in recent weeks in the aftermath of the devastating terrorist assaults on the World Trade Center towers in New York City and the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. And it echoes a question that was asked repeatedly in the late 1940s and 1950s as the United States struggled with the dilemmas of the atomic age. Civil defense has a long history. The Office of Civilian Defense in World War II oversaw a network of air raid warning systems and warden schemes. Then the atomic bomb changed the equation. The first effort involved the dispersion of America's urban and industrial capacity. As early as 1946, nuclear physicist Edward Teller and two colleagues argued that American cities along the East Coast were particularly vulnerable to the devastating impact of atomic bombs. Science fiction author Robert Heinlein made a similar point when he observed, "The cities must go, only villages must remain." President Harry Truman announced a national industrial dispersion policy, but while new defense plants were often built in less congested areas, an effort to disperse federal government buildings failed. A proposal for blast-proof shelters faltered on the question of cost. Instead, the administration decided to cajole people, wherever they lived, to protect themselves from danger. The duck-and-cover campaign was the result. Just as people were told that they could save themselves by getting out of central cities, now they were coaxed to put their hands over their heads, duck under their desks, and so survive an attack. Bert the Turtle stressed the need to take cover from flying glass and other debris in case of a raid. An animated film contained a lively jingle. There was a turtle by the name of Bert, and Bert the Turtle was very alert. When danger threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do. He'd duck and cover, duck and cover. He did what we all must learn to do, you and you and you and you, duck and cover. Then came the development of the hydrogen bomb that made duck and cover obsolete. President Dwight Eisenhower's answer was a program of evacuation to rural regions if attacked. The orientation changed, according to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, from duck and cover to run like hell. But evacuation required an adequate system of roads. The 1956 Act creating an interstate highway system provided easier access to the suburbs as well as a means of exiting the cities in case of nuclear war. The whole notion of evacuation, however, was compromised by the growing awareness of the consequences of fallout. Radioactive dust that remained deadly without some shield now provided a growing interest in fallout shelters far cheaper than blast shelters. Shelter building came of age in the Eisenhower years. In 1951, Life magazine highlighted backyard shelters in California, ranging from an $8 wood-covered dirt hole to a $5,500 complex with telephone, radio, water supply, and Geiger counter. At the end of 1960, there were about 1 million family shelters nationwide. Even with shelters, survival wasn't assured. People, then and now, were no safer in cities than in the suburbs. Indeed, in the words of physician David Bradley, who witnessed atomic tests in the Pacific in 1946, there really was no place to hide.
You've been listening to Alan M. Winkler, Distinguished Professor of History at Miami University in Ohio, and the author of Life Under a Cloud, American Anxiety About the Atom. Winkler's op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. This is Talking History. Midwinter may not be the best time to go in search of historic sites, but you may need a break from the stack of books you've gathered for the season. How about taking a look at a couple of CDs offering some very interesting historical information and attractive images? Here to tell you about two such CDs is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
So you can't decide where you want to visit on your next vacation, or maybe you don't think you have time to visit, say, Ellis Island. The CD-ROM, The Ellis Island Experience, gives you more than 2 hours of sightseeing using audio, video, still photos, and text on a variety of topics, including why immigrants fled the Old World, their voyages to the U.S., what they encountered once they landed at Ellis Island, and how they adapted to their new country. There are oral histories with fascinating details, and there is an interactive game where you are an immigrant and you have to get past the immigration inspector. The CD is $40 and is available at Amazon.com. And the CD-ROM American Dresses, 1780 to 1900, chronicles the changes in women's clothing during that time with more than 300 photographs and sketches. It highlights collections housed at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston and the Costume Institute at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. You can navigate the CD-ROM like a book, or travel to a specific time period, with each chapter representing a decade. The CD-ROM is available for $49.95 from the Cornell University Resource Center.
And finally, for our coming attractions segment, we call to your attention two events where you can learn more about the history of ancient Egypt. On February 27th, tune in Egypt's Golden Empire on your local PBS station. The program tells the story of the rise and fall of the first empire in history, the Egyptian Kingdom. It's the most extraordinary chapter in the history of ancient Egypt, when it reached its height of power and influence in the world. By the end of the pre-Christian or pre-Common era, the Egyptian Empire had largely run its course, but reigning over what remained was one of history's most famous women, Cleopatra. Cleopatra of Egypt, From History to Myth, now open at the Field Museum in Chicago, tells her story. The exhibit traces her life through her ascension to the throne at age 18, her celebrated love affairs with Julius Caesar and Mark Antony, and her suicide at 39. It also confronts the legend that has grown up around her during the 2,000 years since her death. The exhibition, Cleopatra of Egypt, is at Chicago's Field Museum through March 3rd. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. And until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.